You're listening to the 16th episode of The Gear Heart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. Renee White is the voice of our female characters. Got a hankering for all original geeky crafter content? Renee White's site, The Domestic Scientist, is there to brighten your day. She's been featured to date on internet giants such as Kotaku, Joystick, and printed in Nintendo Power. Find out what all the buzz is about at www.thedomesticscientist.com. If you haven't had a chance yet, or you're listening on iTunes, you can stop by the Gearheart blog and interact at www.thegearheart.com. Or you can email me directly at alex@thegearheart.com. Don't forget that you can also follow us on Twitter, username TheGearHeart. And now, pour a cup of tea, settle in, and enjoy as we bring you more tales of The Gearheart. Last time, on The Gearheart, Jonathan finally sees what has become of Isabel and finds himself unable to reconcile his fears. Both Isabel and the Seeress pass new information to Jonathan regarding the mysterious hangman. How will Jonathan react to the knowledge that another Antonello lives? Find out this week on The Gearheart. As the last bit of breath issued from the Seeress's mouth, the world ceased to move. The Seeress stayed stock still, as though she was merely a wax replica of herself. Jonathan felt his stomach sink as he stood and looked around. The air was like molasses, and it was almost painful to move through its viscous mass.
Slade!
He called, but he knew better. The odds that Auden Slade could communicate in Jonathan's visions were slim, as the tyrant had never done it before. Jonathan looked up at the ceiling and saw no butterflies, but he knew they would be frozen in time if they were there.
Why do my visions always have to be like this? Why can't they be pretty butterflies like hers?
Jonathan felt the roots shift beneath his feet, but when he looked down, he didn't see flagstones and roots at all. All that he could see was perfect blue water, inches below his heels. Surprised, he flailed against gravity, but plummeted backward into the pool below. The water was ice cold, and it sucked the breath right out of the poor young man as he struggled in a direction that he hoped was upward. Just when he didn't think he could get any colder, Jonathan broke the surface, and the frosty air came into his scalp. He gasped and yelped, but managed to maintain his bearings. He didn't quite recognize his surroundings, but somehow knew that he was far below Cerceval Palace. Blazing electric lights high overhead illuminated a massive stone tunnel with a watery floor. To Jonathan's left was a stairwell leading up into the darkness and what could only have been a gangplank mounted on a stone dock. Snowflakes drifted in from a grate in the ceiling and alighted upon the water, disappearing. Dead ahead of the young man, a sheer wall connected the ceiling to the base of the tunnel. Jonathan spat and sputtered as he made his way toward the dock and hauled himself up onto the side.
Please don't be real. Please don't be real,
he chattered to himself. There he lay, catching his breath and convulsing under the weight of the cold, when he heard a lilting piccolo. The music wandered up and down in a rather precise pattern, yet fairly abstract. If there was a melody that the instrumentalist was following, it was lost on Jonathan. The harbinger shot up and scooted back against the wall, trembling as he turned around. What he spied was a small, steam-powered trawler, outriggers folded at its side, making passage down the tunnel toward him. One red and one green lantern bobbed beside it in the darkness, casting an eerie light upon the stone walls. The vessel looked like any other fishing trawler, rusted and scratched along the sides, with a stack spewing coal smoke on top. The man on the bow held a tiny silver piccolo and pocketed it as he finished his song. He then picked up a large, finely crafted lantern, which bore the crest of the Seekers in silhouette over the flame. He projected the image onto the far wall over Jonathan, a sign that the boat belonged to the organization.
"What ho there!"
called the man.
"Hey!"
returned Jonathan, but the man didn't seem to notice him.
"I say ahoy there!"
the man shouted, but Jonathan realized it was no use to respond. The man turned to face the bridge, nonplussed.
"I don't see anyone,"
he shouted to the other crew members. A stern-faced captain poked his head out from the wheelhouse and scowled.
"Oi!"
he shouted.
"Show yourselves! We've got a drop to make here!"
No one responded from the dock, save for Jonathan, who futilely waved his arms once more, just to make certain that he couldn't interact with his surroundings. The sailors blithely continued without acknowledging his presence, solidifying Jonathan's assumptions. Jonathan, harbinger of the Cirrus, was cold and wet and helpless to do anything about it until the vision ended.
"What do we do, sir?"
asked the man with the lantern.
"Our jobs, bosun. Get on with it."
Two other sailors rounded the side of the wheelhouse from the stern and grabbed ropes in preparation to dock.
"This place gives me the creeps,"
one of the other sailors complained.
"Quit your whining. The channel floor is a full fathom from the keel."
"Not that, sir,"
the sailor soothed.
"I just don't like sailing through the palace catacombs is all."
"Didn't you?"
the captain breathed, giving the sailor an evil eye.
"Well, perhaps I should get that pretty little girl in the hold to come up and have a go at your job. I'll handle this, captain. Get us tied off, Mr. Simpson,"
the bosun chided.
"I'm just saying,"
the sailor called Simpson, continued in whispered tones to the bosun.
"There should have been a detachment of agents or queensmen here to meet us."
"Well, they're late, Simpson. Just do your job and we can get out of here."
Jonathan made his way to the bottom of the stairwell and took a look around. Somehow he doubted that the pickup team was simply late, or this event wouldn't be important enough to foresee. As he peered over the side of the docks closest to the wall, he spotted something. At first, it looked like a pile of trash, aggregated into the corner, bobbing limply against the wall. As the bosun's lamp swept over the area, hues of crimson glinted at Jonathan from the silhouetted mass. He stared harder, but couldn't quite make out what the automotive-sized clump of objects was. Then Jonathan spotted a pale, cadaverous hand, tangled amid the trash.
"Hey!"
he shouted as he leapt to his feet and bolted toward the boat with all of the speed that he could muster.
"Hey, stop! You have to turn around!"
Jonathan took a flying leap across 6 feet of water and rolled onto the deck of the trawler in a single, clumsy motion. The sailor called Simpson stepped right over him as Jonathan scrambled to his feet.
"You're in danger! You have to run!"
the harbinger yelled. The sailors didn't notice him. Jonathan steeled himself for what he was certain was coming. He tried his best to control his shivering and power through the cold. He needed to hone his senses and observe every element of the coming tragedy, because he wasn't sure he would get to see it again. A beautiful, blonde girl made her way onto the deck from the holds below. Her full lips twitched briefly into a scowl, but then returned to indifference. Her wide, azure eyes surveyed the surrounding area, sweeping across the darkened waters of the tunnel. She was petite, no older than 18, with an aristocratic posture that seemed strange for someone exiting the bowels of a ship. The girl was clad in a lacy black dress that offset the perfection of her skin and shimmering hair. The other sailors couldn't help but sneak glances as she passed.
"Agent Manners,"
the captain called.
"I trust the ride in wasn't too bumpy."
"Thank you for having me, Captain. It was fine,"
she replied, straightening her collar.
"You're just saying that, madam,"
the captain laughed.
"A girl like you belongs on a nice luxury."
The tunnel flashed, and a sudden gust of air slapped across Jonathan's face as all sounds vanished, replaced by muffled versions of themselves. Jonathan was vaguely aware of something deafening sounding through the air, but his eardrums were shot. In the space of a heartbeat, something tore across the blonde girl's neck, spraying blood across the deck as her head tumbled from her shoulders. The world stopped like a clock, unwinding as Agent Manners' skull thumped against the ground. And as her perfect platinum plates touched the deck, they sprouted into vines, ravenously devouring the boat as the tunnel crumbled overhead. The skin tones of the captain and the other sailors fell into a dull gray, and eventually their clothes were overtaken with a drab color, and they exploded into ashes. Jonathan tried to flee, but something wrapped around his ankle. The plants shot up Jonathan's leg, tearing across his calves and inner thighs and leaving jagged cuts in their wake. He screamed as the sky opened overhead into a roaring storm against the ruins of the tunnel's sides. In the distance, he spotted a lone silhouette, flapping in the rain. It was avian, like a blackbird. But Jonathan couldn't quite make it out before the vines pulled him to the deck and slashed across his eyes, painting his vision in searing darkness. Then gradually, the world began to reappear in hazy shapes and shades of blue. Jonathan's body warmed, and his palms and knees felt cool stone pressing against him. The lines around Jonathan became sharp again, yielding golden lays in azure stone and roots running over the surface of the floor. Lastly, he brought himself to focus on the concerned, milky eyes of the Cirrus.
"What did you see, child?"
Jonathan swallowed hard.
"One of the Seekers is going to die."
Sadness overtook the Cirrus's visage, and her lip trembled ever so slightly.
"Who is it, Jonathan?"
"I don't know her. They called her Agent Manners."
"Maeve,"
the Cirrus thought aloud.
"Her whole chapter was killed, except for her and one other. She was coming here to debrief."
"I take it that not a lot of people know that she's coming?"
"Her chapter,"
she rasped, eyes distant,
was killed by one of its own members, Astrid Blofeld."
"And you couldn't take the chance that anyone else would finish it, so she's coming in secretly? Who else knew?"
asked Jonathan.
"I informed two officiates and a party of six Queensmen."
"None of them can be trusted."
"I'm afraid I must reluctantly agree, my child. You shall go in their stead, taking only those you trust,"
said the Cirrus. Jonathan laughed uncomfortably.
"My lady, I'm not certain that there's anything I can do when I can't even call on my own power."
"If the time comes, you will know the right thing to do, Harbinger. After all, you are the only one who knows how Maeve Manners will die."
Jonathan licked his lips and considered his next words.
"Actually, I didn't see it,"
he finally said.
"Then you must go now, Jonathan. Agent Manners' survival is critical. Headmaster Wilkinson should be familiar with the route to the secret tunnel."
"Understood."
Another man, a Lord Officiate, entered the room as Jonathan made his way through the door.
Lord Officiate,"
Jonathan saluted.
"Harbinger,"
the Lord Officiate replied. As Jonathan rushed down the hallway, he heard the distant voice of the Cirrus say,
"Lord Officiate Latchley, to what do I owe this pleasure?"
"I won't do it, Father!"
Elena shouted as the inferno raged around her. A sickening nausea poured through Elena's body as she lurched on the ground, trying not to lose consciousness. It was a surreal suffering, so intense because it was independent of her body. Her father had simply uttered a word and brought Elena and all of her new power to her knees. As she clutched at the rubble of the burning castle of Audenslade, she knew only despair. The man stood over her, staff raised high above his head, poised to strike. Elena knew exactly what was in that implement, naught but death and dissolution. The gleaming eagle's head that capped the staff shrieked as the reflection of the flames licked across its brassy surface. Jacopo Antonello's oak-colored face was rife with wrinkles, but his tremendous black beard offset his age. Greasy locks of his jet hair fluttered about in the heated winds of the burning castle as he took another step toward his fallen daughter. He affixed his green eyes upon the crown of her head, and his curly black eyebrows wove a scowl upon his face.
"Do not call me father if you refuse to be my daughter, Elena."
"A father would have grieved the loss of his own son,"
she cried out in rage. Even though her body was mere clockwork and dead flesh, the sensations of pain were amazing. Jacopo's staff struck her hard across her arm, and she tumbled away as though she had been thrown like a rag doll. Had she needed to breathe, Elena would have been knocked breathless. Her father's image split into three as her crystalline right eye cracked against the wall during impact.
"That is between us, and a woman should know her place. Your brother gave his life for this family, and it is not the right of a mere woman to question my motives,"
Jacopo stated coldly, striding forward.
"Especially one as useless as you."
Elena didn't believe that her mechanical heart could ache, but it did in that moment. Elena found that her father had even built her with tears. She desperately looked into Jacopo's eyes, searching for some semblance of the man who loved her. What she found was ice wrapped in fire.
"I won't fight Slade,"
she mumbled, trying to rise to her feet.
"I won't steal the kingdom for you, father, and sully our honor by renouncing fealty."
Jacopo sneered, baring his yellowed teeth through his long black beard.
"Don't foolishly presume that you know anything about honor. Caldavia is mine by right, and an Antonello would know that."
"But you swore to King On—"
This time the staff caught her across her face, flinging her head to one side and sending shattering pain down her neck. Elena felt the wind passing over her arms as she spun in midair and her orientation disappeared. By the time she knew where she was, the ground rushed up to meet her.
"I need no validation from a glorified commoner,"
he bellowed.
"That slave mutt can never be the true king."
Elena screamed as she rolled over a pile of scorching debris, but she could not call her sword. The sickness brought upon her body by Jacopo's command word was too much to concentrate. The air around her felt greasy, and the world danced in her dizzy eyes.
"I won't do it, father,"
she panted.
"I won't go in there and fight him."
Jacopo strode forward, through the flames and over the debris, his robes magically repelling the fire as he walked. He came to stand before the fallen warrior and gazed upon her with sad eyes. He knelt down and stroked her hair, much as a craftsman admiring his own work.
"You were my daughter once, Elena, but now you are merely a broken cog in my machine. You have no name, no family. You are not one of us."
Jacopo clutched the amulet around Elena's neck as she wept profusely.
"Papa,"
she sobbed.
"Please, don't."
"But there is something wonderful about machines. I suppose it's why I like them so much. You see, just like a broken cog, you can be replaced. Just like a failed experiment, you can be aborted."
"Please, Papa,"
Elena begged.
"Please don't kill me."
Jacopo inspected the amulet, admiring its quality.
"I don't believe I will, Cog. While I made the gear heart flawlessly, and that is something I can appreciate. This gem,"
he muttered with fire in his eyes,
"why could I not replicate it?"
"Papa."
"I won't smash it, Cog. I'm not done inspecting it."
And with a quick jerk of Jacopo's hand, the darkness closed around Elena's eyes. How will Cog react to the knowledge of another Antonello, and will he also haunt her dark dreams? Will Jonathan save Maeve Manners from her fate, or is she doomed to die? Find out next time on The Gearheart. This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
This week's podcast has been brought to you by Golden Pen Brand Plot Devices, crutches for the common rider. Are you writing a novel but feeling a little slow on the uptake? Come to Golden Pen for any of our fine array of twists, quibbles, red herrings, MacGuffins, and deus ex machina. Feeling like your family drama needs a little pop? How about a 16-year-old with cancer for a nice cheap punch in the gut that'll leave your readers reeling? And remember, if it ain't Golden Pen, it just ain't in. And by Dr. Seuss's Concentrated Hooper Snoopers. Feeling a little under, lacking that thunder? Come up to the Blat for an off on the plat, because when you're Bjergen, Pjergen, Mjergen, Jergen, ba-boom-boff-bug-schnergen-jergen.